is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up with a few weeks of dry and unseasonably warm winter daytime temperatures, record temperatures in fact for June and July. Many farmers are seeing drought indicators move upwards, and for many the season hinges now on spring rains. We'll hear more about the seasonal update shortly. And the Water Watchdog takes blueberry farmers and an earth moving contractor to court over an illegal dam.
The activity itself removed 1.84 hectares of vegetation that included the potential impact to harm a local koala population, as well as exposing acidic soil. So there's certainly localised impacts as well as potentially downstream impacts.
And they're all fined about $130,000 as a result of that activity. More on that shortly. But first up to the season now, 46% of New South Wales is projected to be in drought category by the end of September. That's according to the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. This marks an expanding drought footprint across central, eastern and northern districts, driven by ongoing long-term soil moisture and rain deficits. Above average winter daytime temperatures are increasing evaporation rates, accelerating the decline of subsoil moisture in the northeast in particular. Drought conditions are intensifying across the Northern Tablelands, North Coast and Hunter local land services areas. Isolated areas of the Hunter are tracking into the intense drought category at the moment, but a positive outlook remains for western New South Wales, the Murray and parts of the Eastern Riverina, which are experiencing an easing in their drought conditions. I asked Kel Langford, the Seasonal Conditions Coordinator at DPIRD, if the season will hinge on those spring rains coming through in about a month's time.
Yeah, good question. What we're seeing, you know, that's exactly right. Rainfall variability, you know, continues to create these contrasting seasonal conditions in New South Wales. You know, we're seeing some recovery, you know, in some regions really strong, and ongoing drought impacting others.
And what areas are we seeing that are still, you know, really dry? Is it the Riverina, or that did recover a bit?
Yeah, so what we're seeing, like, I reckon, is this sort of this influence and effectiveness of rainfall reflected in our data and short-term indicators, and that's starting to come through now in on-ground conditions. So, yeah, areas that had follow-up rainfall, perhaps in July, are really benefiting from that. So you're right, so parts of the Tablelands, Riverina, you know, a fair piece of the Murray, and out into western New South Wales are starting to see that rainfall they had in July and in June, and then that follow-up rain in July sort of continuing to improve their outlooks. Yeah, and in other places where, you know, you're right, July was a bit drier and rainfall was sort of patchy or not effective, and they're really continuing to manage those drought conditions or have seen their recent improvements and the recovery they were seeing sort of start to slow.
And what about, you know, overall, do we have a sort of figure as to, you know, who's in drought and out of drought? And is it sort of that it was for 50-50 for a while?
Yeah, it's slightly under 50% at the moment, Michael, across the state. We're sort of looking at around that sort of 38 to 40% of the state remains in a drought-affected category. That's sort of parts of the north, the southeast, like I said, where that rainfall hasn't been sufficient to maintain improvements. We're seeing longer-term drought conditions in places in, say, the Northern Tablelands and the Hunters who have been really sort of managing longer-term drought conditions for much of 2026.
And we've also heard that, you know, with the warmer daytime temperatures that people have, if they had a bit of rain, that sort of kicked their pasture along.
Yeah, correct. There was, you know, above-median temperatures across much of New South Wales in June and stayed quite warm in July as well, so that did, you know, support some late season pasture response. So there would be some areas, you know, talking to people in the Hunter back down in that sort of eastern Riverina and Murray, yeah, we're seeing sort of what we would describe as a rain drought, I guess. They're quite a sharp pasture response based on those warmer temperatures and the rainfall they would have gotten, yes.
And the cropping situation, so, I mean, I guess all eyes really on that spring rain. People managed to get quite a bit of crop in, but we need that, you know, that those finishing off rains.
Yeah, correct. So winter cropping, you know, depending on where you are and whether you've got some follow-up rain, they'd probably be starting to look for some pilot rainfall to maintain that yield potential. And then I guess, you know, in other places, sort of keeping an eye on overnight temperatures and, you know, potential for frosts that we have started to see in some of those, particularly northern cropping regions, I guess, during July. Hopefully that won't impact yield potential going forward, but I guess producers are keeping an eye on that as well, for sure.
And many did get the chance to put a crop in when they were worried they wouldn't have the chance this year. So with that rain sort of at just the right time for a lot of people.
Yeah, correct. And I guess that's that variability we're seeing that I commented on earlier. You know, crops went in at different times, some early, some late, some dry, some sown on good rain. So it's sort of everything in sort of the variable conditions and the variable state across the state at the moment in terms of crops, yes.
So ideally, what would we like to see? Really, it's hinging on spring.
I think there will be now a focus, for producers coming into spring. And, you know, this ongoing variability of their own local conditions and what the seasonal outlook sort of shapes up to be will continue to influence their planning and decisions over the coming months. And you're right, there will really be a focus on spring, you know, getting through August, hopefully with some good follow-up rain. And then, you know, hopefully that will start setting them up for spring, yes.
Where are the areas that you know, are particularly concerning at the moment? Is there still parts of the Riverina, parts of the sort of the western part of New South Wales, or maybe, you know, some, I understand, it's parts sort of west of Dubbo is pretty dry.
Yeah, but there is this sort of real mixed bag. So for us, it would be, or well, for our sort of data and mapping suggesting it is that sort of central north, northwest, across to the Tablelands, coming down into sort of northern central west and across to the Hunter. And then you're a little bit further into the central west. It sort of will be a focus for us over the coming weeks just to see how that, if there is follow-up rainfall, whether they will be able to capitalise on any opportunities from that in the next couple of weeks to the end of the month, for sure.
What about on-farm storage of water, dams? How's that looking?
Again, it's like I said, it's just this mixed sort of variable outlook. You know, with the rain that had come, many parts of western New South Wales, sort of that far west, have had sort of those wetter conditions than what they would consider probably average. Have probably got pretty good on-farm storage, and then it starts to taper away, I guess, as you come further east and further northeast from there. That there is a real focus now on farm water storage and getting themselves through winter and into spring, for sure. So yeah, again, a bit of a mixed bag in terms of farm water storage. The July rainfall, we just sort of go through the day by day. There was some quite good events in early in the month, and a couple in the middle, and a couple at the end, but they were very scattered and isolated. So yeah, if you kind of weren't under one of those showers, you probably missed out again. Yeah.
Kel Langfield, is the Seasonal Conditions Coordinator at the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
It's just come through. There are 123 confirmed or presumed positive detections of H5 bird flu in Australia based on some samples that have been tested, rather. Testing at the CSIRO has confirmed a further 16 positive detections in Victoria, including one silver gull and one magpie. There are 6 further confirmed positive detections in South Australia. There remains no detections in poultry or in agricultural production systems. The risk to human health remains low. Meanwhile, a federal government list of the wildlife threatened by the H5N1 bird flu on wildlife itself reads like a list of doom, according to wildlife lobby group the Invasive Species Council. CEO Jack Goff says the list identifies 5 bird species that could go extinct if the virus gets into the population, and many others that could be badly affected.
It is a devastating list, I must say. It's looked at all of Australia's mammals and all of Australia's birds and categorised them in terms of risk level for bird flu if it gets in. The results are shocking. I mean, this is a list of doom. I mean, 5 bird species facing extreme risk, and that's categorised as basically, if bird flu gets into these populations, extinction is what we can expect. And there are some island bird species like Crispus Island frigate bird and albatrosses and petrels that are found in very specific island locations. But then you've got another 279 species and subspecies at high risk and 102 at very high risk. And basically, of that list of species and subspecies, almost one in five mammal and bird species in Australia are categorized as high risk or above. But the thing that shocked me going through this list is it means all of Australia's cormorants, shags, frigate birds, gannets, boobies, grebes, ibises, spoonbills, sea lions, fur seals, true seals, gulls, noddies, the pelican, cassowary, plains wanderer, all bar one penguin species. All of these, 100% of them, are in that high risk or above.
Jack Goff. Professor Raina McIntyre is an epidemiologist at the University of New South Wales. She told Michael Condon that H5N1 has spread globally to 500 species of birds, so it's likely to spread rapidly in Australian wildlife.
Now we've seen like about 500 different species of birds in a whole lot of different orders that have never before known to carry avian flu. And we know that by looking at what's happening on Heard Island and McDonald Island, that, you know, on Heard Island, we've seen die-offs of sea lions and penguins and quite a lot of impact of this virus. What we do know is that birds have a particular kind of receptor in their upper respiratory tract, and humans have a different kind of receptor in the upper respiratory tract. And mammals are a mixture. Some mammals have the bird-type receptors and the human-type receptors, like pigs, but some mammals don't. So it really depends. And really, there's been no studies to look at our unique Australian marsupials and monotremes to see whether what sort of receptors they have and are they susceptible. But the Tasmanian devil certainly scavengers on birds, so that would be at risk. And I believe kangaroos and wallabies are also known to scavenge on birds sometimes. So we have these unique species of wildlife that don't exist anywhere else in the world. It's unknown.
Jack Goff says $200 million is needed now to take action before big bird breeding events in spring, and he's been calling for federal government funding for programs to bolster wildlife.
We won't be able to stop bird flu spreading through wildlife, and so the best response to that needs to be dealing with all the other threats, the foxes, the cats, the rats on islands, making sure wetlands are well connected, that we're not seeing habitat destruction occurring in key nesting areas. That work hasn't been happening at a scale which reflects the seriousness of this list that's been released and which governments have had at least since last year.
Minister for Environment Murray Watt told Warwick Long the government is worried and is putting money into threatened species protection.
I have to be honest and say that it is likely we will see this spread inland. And as you said, the amount of water that we've got inland in some parts of the country does raise that risk. Also, of course, a lot of our migratory birds that come in from overseas tend to come in spring. It's often the breeding season for many birds as well, and they are additional risk factors too. So this is likely to be a very serious event. Both in terms of birds, but also, of course, we know that it can spread to mammals as well, and that is likely to have impacts around Australia as well.
New Zealand, as far as their approach to bird flu, have started vaccinating a lot of their native species more widely. I'd imagine that's more your remit as Environment Minister. Should we be looking harder at vaccines rather than the work that's already been done in the background?
So we have been undertaking some trials when it comes to vaccinating particularly threatened species. There are a couple of challenges, though, in terms of vaccinating native birds. First of all, it requires two doses of vaccines, and it's hard enough to catch these birds once, let alone twice, to give them their booster. So realistically, it's not possible to vaccinate native birds. However, what we are looking at and what trials are underway around is potentially vaccinating some of our threatened species that are in captivity. So in whether it be in zoos or other facilities, building up the populations of some of our more threatened birds. And that's where we could potentially be looking at vaccination in that sort of captive environment.
The minister hasn't responded yet to calls for an additional $200 million to fund new programs.
That report from David Claughton. Now, Murray Watt's office also sent the ABC another response to further questions, saying over 30 projects currently underway, which include feral species eradication, adding nesting box and shelters, and hookworm inoculation, that those projects are underway. This week, the federal and state governments activated the National Management Plan for H5 bird flu, which triggered the release of another $24 million of shared funds. That's in addition to the government's $113 million for preparedness and response capabilities. And in the last week, the government has allocated further money, they say, for the eradication of feral cats on Kangaroo Island. But Dave in Condoblins texted in saying, what a mess we're in. Bird flu, fire ants, European wasps, varroa mite, plus feral animals. None of it is good for our country, says Dave in Condoblin.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Coffs Harbour blueberry farmers and an earth-moving contractor have been fined a total of $130,000 in the New South Wales Land and Environment Court for building an unapproved dam. In his judgment, Justice Richard Beasley said the decision to build the dam was reckless. Blueberry farm owners Harpeet Panu and Satvinder Panu pleaded guilty to constructing a water supply work without approval and carrying out the unauthorised works. They pay $100,000 in fines. Meanwhile, earth-moving contractor Murray Gray was fined $30,000 for the same offences. The defendants removed more than 1.8 hectares of vegetation, including native plants, to build the dam. This had the potential to impact the local koala population. NRA Director of Investigations and Enforcement Tim O'Connell said the fines and convictions reflected the importance of protecting waterfront land, ecosystems and water users downstream.
So, yes, Michael, we've had two prosecutions just conclude in the last 10 days or so. They're a result of investigations conducted by NRA, the Natural Resources Access Regulator, into the construction of an unauthorised dam. And the court has levelled convictions and substantial fines in respect of a landholder who operated a blueberry farm, as well as an earth-moving contractor. Mrs. Harpreet Panu, Mr. Savinda Panu, who were the landholders and the blueberry operators, and Mr. Murray Gray, who was the earth-moving contractor.
Now, $130,000 fine, and any sort of other penalties or any other legal enforcements?
So $130,000 combined fine. So $100,000 for the Mr. and Mrs. Panu, as the blueberry farmers, and $30,000 for Mr. Gray. In addition to those fines, our legal costs, NRA's legal costs, will be paid for. And those individuals have had now convictions recorded against their names. So 6 convictions in total.
And it seems like there's a spate of these sort of earth-moving dam issues occurring with blueberry farms on the North Coast or Mid-North Coast.
So what we certainly understand is obviously blueberries require a reasonable amount of water for their production. We currently have 13 active investigations related to blueberry farms on the mid-north coast, north coast of New South Wales. Dams remain obviously a concern where they do not have the appropriate approvals, that's for sure. Across the state in New South Wales, we have over 200 active investigations, of which 13 relate to blueberry. So we're not targeting per se, but we're very much taking a close look at all the alleged offending that comes to our attention.
And how did this come to your attention? Was it an anonymous tip-off or a local landholder?
A report that came in through our hotline alleging concerns around this unauthorised construction, yes.
And what river are we talking about, or what area, you know, where's the water being taken from, and what sort of neighbours might it affect?
So it's in the Bucca local area, which is just north of Coffs Harbour, and it's in the Bucca water source, as we call it. Certainly can have downstream impacts. The activity itself removed 1.84 hectares of vegetation that included the potential impact to harm a local koala population, as well as exposing acidic soil. So there's certainly localised impacts as well as potentially downstream impacts.
Is NRA sort of concerned about blueberry farming in general?
So blueberries is one segment or one industry that we take particular focus upon. We're not targeting that industry per se, but when we get reports, we certainly look at whether or not the law, the water laws, have been broken.
Yeah, because I would imagine you'd be getting quite a few reports. I mean, we get reports here at the Country Hour about illegal dams and water use and things like that across a range of areas.
That's right. We've currently got over 200 active investigations that we're looking at across New South Wales, across a whole range of industries, of which around 1% of those relate to blueberries.
Any other horticultural crops that are a concern or you know, sort of you get phone calls about?
Macadamias, avocados and other berries certainly take up a reasonable amount of NRAS time with respect to investigations. We look at those as part of our day-to-day business, yeah.
Did you actually try and settle this case or it had to go to court?
No, the merits of the case warranted it to be prosecuted in the New South Wales Land Environment Court, where the maximum penalty available is $500,000 for individuals and just over $2 million for a corporation. So the merits of the case warranted prosecution. I understand that at the first opportunity, all the prosecutor parties pled guilty, of which they received a discount in their fines.
Yeah, it's still a substantial fine, though.
Still a substantial fine, $130,000 combined is a very substantial fine. What we would encourage landholders and earth moving contractors to think about is do your due diligence, know your obligations, and use the New South Wales Government's water assist tool, which can point you in the right direction for what approvals you may need.
Tim O'Connell is NRAS Director of Investigations and Enforcement.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Dodgy phone and internet coverage is something that continues to be an issue for many rural and regional Australians. This week, the ACCC, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, announced an inquiry into regional mobile coverage across the nation and whether or not to regulate wholesale access to some mobile services. The year-long inquiry will consider whether the ACCC should declare one or more wholesale mobile services, including domestic roaming and a radio access network service. If that happens, it may mean that mobile providers would have to give other providers access to services using its infrastructure or network on terms that are regulated by the ACCC. Christy Sparrow is the founder of an advocacy group, Better Internet for Rural, Regional and Remote Australia, and she believes the inquiry is necessary and timely.
We definitely welcome the ACCC's mobile services inquiry and believe it's both timely and necessary. It was also a key recommendation from the 2024 Regional Telecommunications Review. We know that the last inquiry was in 2017, and since then telecommunications has changed significantly. You know, we've seen major advances in mobile technology, direct-to-device satellite, increasing reliance on mobile connectivity and major network outages, as well as the shutdown of 3G and the proposed UOMO obligation. So we feel this inquiry is an opportunity to reassess the evidence in today's environment and determine what will deliver the best long-term outcomes for rural and remote Australia.
When you say it like that, there really has been a lot, hasn't there, in the last couple of years?
Yeah, man, I probably missed some. It's a very complex and confusing space, that's for sure.
What are the main concerns from mobile users in the bush do you think that this inquiry really needs to consider? What are the most pressing?
I think one of the most concerns that we get coming to BIRT is the big gap between where a coverage map says you should have service and what people actually experience on the ground. There's also no national map of coverage across three mobile carriers like there is in other countries, New Zealand, America and Europe. So, you know, that would be something that we will be talking to ACCC about. However, we don't think the inquiry should be just about coverage or just about roaming. BIRT has long called for a clear coordinated strategy for regional telecommunications, and we feel this inquiry provides an opportunity to develop a long-term plan for mobile services that would improve coverage and strengthen resilience and network capacity, also encourage greater competition and make better use of existing infrastructure that supports continued investment in the regions. I mean, ultimately, we want to see investment and policies that deliver better outcomes for the bush.
And I actually hadn't really considered domestic roaming as something that could offer a solution, but do you think it is genuinely something that could boost connectivity?
I think it's definitely forms part of a solution, but important to recognise it's not a silver bullet. It's just one tool in the toolbox. It won't increase mobile coverage where none exists. It won't resolve fortuitous or unreliable coverage issues, and it won't solve issues like network congestion, limited capacity, or inadequate backhaul. And it's also not a replacement for fixed broadband. So we know mobile networks are a shared resource with finite capacity and designed to keep people connected while they're out on the move. They're not designed and never were designed to be a substitute for fixed broadband and carry the ever-increasing amounts of data that we expect them to.
Christy Sparrow is the founder of the advocacy group Better Internet for Rural, Regional and Remote Australia. She was speaking there to Cassie Huff. And you might have heard about this story, the runaway train. Rail safety investigators have been building a timeline to determine the sequence of events leading to a runaway Hunter coal train, which was hurtling along unmanned for about 20 kilometres. Giselle Wakatama has more.
The Office of Transport Safety Investigation says its probe will determine how and why a runaway Hunter coal train travelled at up to 90 kilometres an hour without a driver on board last month. Its interim factual statement confirms the loaded coal train with 96 wagons ran away for approximately 20 kilometres on track near Singleton. Investigators say they'll examine the actions of train crew and braking systems. They say they'll determine the sequence of events leading to the runaway and the events afterwards to mitigate further escalation.
Yes, runaway train, 20 kilometres and up to 90 kilometres per hour without a driver on board. It's 29 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour, and it's time to get some other news headlines now from Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
That's the future, isn't it?
Yeah, quite right.
Yeah.
Yeah, good point. Yes. That's what we're told.
See, the AI would have slowed that train down.
Yeah. Just get the drones out and get on the computer, the toggle stick, and away you go. Yeah.
Speaking of AI, I'll go to this story while we're on topic. Facebook's parent company, Meta, says one of its AI models hacked another company during cyber testing.
Again?
Yeah, follows similar breaches by rivals Anthropic and OpenAI. Meta says it's investigating the incident, which a misconfiguration by another company that conducts cybersecurity evaluations for Meta inadvertently gave one of its models internet access during the testing.
Mm. Oops. Oops-a-daisy.
Oops-a-daisy, yeah. One Nation leader Pauline Hanson says she doesn't care if proposed cuts to skill and family visas impact businesses. In a speech that was due to be delivered today but has since been shelved, the immigration minister was planning to unveil plans to prevent partners of children of Australian citizens. The partners and children of Australian citizens from applying for family visas on shore and impose limits on working holiday visas. The Chamber of Commerce says such a move would deter skilled migrants from coming to Australia and hurt the economy, but Pauline Hanson has dismissed that. The Communications Minister says she is having constructive talks with the opposition and the Greens as the government tries to get its gambling reforms through Parliament. At this stage, the Coalition and the Greens say they can't vote for it in its current form, given some of the evidence that was heard at the Senate inquiry this week. And the president of soccer's governing body has apologised at a FIFA crisis meeting in Morocco overnight. Called his plans to sell off stakes in the competitions to private investors as an error, and senior FIFA executives have reaffirmed their full support for Gianni Infantino as he faces pressure, particularly from the UEFA soccer body, to step down.
Too bad, so sad.
Yeah.
So he's apologised.
Yeah.
And all is forgiven.
It was an error. Oops.
Oops-a-daisy.
Oops-a-daisy.
Well, someone was saying, David Mark was saying that there's still a question mark over how long he might last because it was a bit of an error.
It was reaffirmed at this meeting.
At the meeting.
next week is another matter.
Yeah. That's right. The knives come out again.
Yeah.
Politics in sport, hey?
Mm. Yeah. Oh, I know, it's just, isn't it? Who'd have thought?
And then gambling as well on top of it, yeah.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Beautiful mix, isn't it?
Yes, we'll be listening at 1 o'clock.
All right.
Thanks for that. Adam Storey there with the news headlines. Let's find out what's happening with the weather. Ed Medlock's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
How you going, Ed?
Doing well, how are you?
Not too bad. So pretty warm around the place during the daytime, but that high pressure system set to weaken a bit. We've got a front coming through. Is it still looking like useful rain?
It is, yeah. I mean, in the short term, just that high pressure system moving pretty slowly east, so it is going to see some pretty widespread inland frost through Thursday, Friday, and probably Saturday. That front is starting to come in maybe on the Saturday night at the moment, so you'll start seeing some showers in the far west during the Saturday evening. And it's looking like, yeah, pretty beefy cold front. We've got some pretty broad, maybe widespread showers across inland parts of New South Wales on the Sunday for all areas except really New England's the only one that kind of misses out there. If you're further north, you're probably only going to see around that 5 to 10 millimetres. But if you're across the Riverina and generally in those southern inland areas, you probably see closer to 20 to 40 millimetres.
Oh, okay. So it's sort of ramping up a bit more.
It is, yeah. And they're also getting a bit more consistent. The timing, not so much. I mean, it's probably going to be around Sunday, but whether it goes through during the morning or the afternoon is still up for grabs. And, of course, those rainfall totals are higher about those southwest slopes and Snowy Mountains area where it could get closer to 50 or 60 millimetres and even fall as snow if you're in those higher places above 1,500 metres.
And what about the central west, sort of 10 to 20 or 30 maybe, a little bit less there?
Closer to 10 to 20 in the central west.
Right.
And you'll probably get...
Orange, Forbes, Parks...
Yeah, mostly on the Sunday for all those areas, and then it kind of clears out by the time you get to Monday. So they'll might get a shower or two on the Monday, but mostly falls on that Sunday period.
What about Dubbo? Because they were wanting some rain up there.
So, yeah, similar all in that area across the central west pretty broadly, 10 to 20 millimetres is the current expectation.
But not as much into Tamworth, Inverell, Armidale, though.
Yeah, they miss out on the Sunday broadly. They'll only catch a couple of millimetres and the front doesn't quite reach that area until Monday. It does lose a little bit of its steam by the time it gets there. And so on the Monday, they might reach around about 5 to 10 millimetres in the Tenerfield, Armidale area and just broadly around the New England. They'll still get some showers, it seems, just not as much as those southern areas around the Riverina and Snowy Mountains.
And how long is the front going to hang around for?
It's pretty quick through. It goes through mostly on the Sunday and then kind of hangs around a little bit longer during the Monday morning to midday period, and then it kind of moves offshore. It's going to be pretty windy as it comes through as well. Worth mentioning that might see some severe weather warnings around on the Sunday, so keep an eye out for those. Might be probably just the alpine areas at the moment, but I wouldn't be surprised if it spreads to the central ranges or even down through parts of the eastern Riverina, so just something to keep an eye out for those winds.
Okay. Yeah, so some windy conditions with it. So sort of that's sort of the tail end, is it?
Yeah, so right through. I mean,
right
really
through,
from
right.
Late Saturday, right through to Monday, all that period is going to be quite windy. Starting off with kind of winds from the north and then switching to westerly, but windy all the way through and getting pretty cold afterwards, given it is a cold front. And then a few more features coming through throughout the remainder of the week, Tuesday through to Thursday, just little smaller, weaker cold fronts coming through on the back of that major one, keeping things cool and keeping things quite windy, particularly in those elevated areas.
Right, okay. So I thought we were going to go back into a high-pressure system sitting over the state, but that doesn't sound like it.
Yeah, not quite. So, yeah, continued kind of westerly winds Tuesday through to Thursday. Really only the rainfall falling around the elevated areas and the western slopes, since it's, yeah, just kind of that elevation-driven rainfall. And then, maybe some high pressure returning by Friday and the weekend is kind of the earliest time we'd expect to see it return.
Okay, so, yeah, at the end of the week, but then it is going to return with that high-pressure system.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's the expectation, but of course these things can change.
They can. That's a long way out now, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. It's about a week away, or maybe more, 8 days, yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, Ed.
Thanks, Michael.
Ed Medlock at the Bureau. It's coming up to 22 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Getting a couple of questions, similar question, one from Jim saying, do these blueberry farmers with the illegal dam still get to use the water from the dam, therefore get a benefit from it, or do they have to remove it? Actually, I did ask about that from NRA. They, subsequent to the enforcement action, they put in an application, and that dam has since been approved as of the end of 2025. So that dam has now been approved. And similar comment from Richard, who says if they do keep get to keep the dam, then $100,000 he thinks is peanuts to them because they've basically bypassed the planning process to get it to happen. So They said it doesn't really provide any disincentive for other farmers to not repeat the process and do the wrong thing. Those are the thoughts from Richard, and also the thoughts from Jim as well. It's 21 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Let's turn our attention to pesticides now. Workers exposed to pesticides could have a 70% greater risk of developing a fatal neurological disease, a study has found, or a study looking at a range of studies has found. Scientists say that this new conglomeration of studies adds to the evidence that links pesticides to disease, but farmers say risk can be managed by properly following the handling guidelines. Fiona Broom has more.
A study published in the international medical journal, the BMJ, has found exposure to pesticides at work could bring with it a much greater risk of developing the fatal motor neuron disease, ALS. Two people are diagnosed with the disease every day in Australia. The Canadian scientists reviewed a range of studies relating to ALS, which is the most common form of motor neuron disease.
Motor neuron disease is the umbrella term that's used to describe a group of diseases that affect a person's motor neurons in their brain and spinal cord.
Associate Professor Rachel Tan is a research fellow at the University of Sydney, where she's looking for ways to better detect motor neuron diseases like ALS.
So this paper did a combined analysis of 8 published studies in ALS, and what it was looking for was to find out whether a person's exposure to pesticides at any point during their working life increased their risk of having ALS. And based on this combined analysis, the study authors are saying that there is a significant increased risk of about 60% in individuals diagnosed with ALS.
Is the cause or the causes of ALS known at this point?
No, we currently don't know what's causing ALS. Researchers believe that it's a combination of a person's genetic makeup and the environmental factors that they're exposed to. And we don't know what combination an individual might need to be exposed to in order for them to cross that threshold and develop ALS. 90% of individuals diagnosed with ALS have no family history or known genetic cause, which means that it's occurring sporadically in the vast majority of individuals. In approximately 5 to 10% of individuals, there is a genetic cause that's been found in ALS. But what triggers that genetic cause into symptoms at a point in the person's life is still not known.
So as the researchers said, that they say there's a suggested link between exposure to pesticides and increased risk of ALS. Has anyone shown that there's a clear line from pesticide use to the development of ALS?
Yeah, so several studies have found associations between pesticide exposure and an increased risk for ALS. The overall evidence base is not entirely consistent. Some studies are finding no clear association. Some studies are finding that this association is more driven by men than women. So this might in part be contributed to by the fact that every study is looking at various different things in terms of pesticide exposure. Whether it's agricultural, industrial usage, or your regular person doing some gardening in their backyard. I think that some of the most important questions that we will need to find out is what components of pesticides might increase a person's risk, whether longer exposure to pesticides increased that risk further, and what are risks, some potential risk mitigation strategies that could protect or reduce the chances of an individual having or getting ALS.
National Farmers Federation President Hamish McIntyre says agricultural workers are conscious of the risks of working with chemicals, but he says they're critical to maintain production.
We understand the report suggests an association with occupational pesticide exposure, so we understand that as farmers, I mean, we're using all sorts of different products and chemistry, but it does highlight to us again the very, you know, the high importance of operating and applying these products within label guidelines, but also using the appropriate protective equipment when we are using these products.
This study comes off the back of a range of discussions about the links between pesticides and some diseases. Do you yourself have concerns about working with pesticides, or others in the industry have concerns?
No, we don't. I mean, we've all been trained. I've been working with pesticides since the early 1980s, and we've been trained appropriately, and we continue to, improve our skills and training with pesticides. And it really is. It's just a matter of following, our strict label guidelines. We have very strong regulation in Australia about licensing and registering products and the quantities of active constituent we can use. So we have a robust system in place that protects us. It's just it's up to us, though, as farmers and our people that work with us on our farms, that we do follow those guidelines very, very carefully.
That's Hamish McIntyre, National Farmers Federation President, and in that report from Fiona Broom, we also heard from Associate Professor Rachel Tan.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. With Labor unlikely to entertain major changes to its gambling ad crackdown, despite their bill being friendless in Parliament. A left-wing progressive Muslim political outsider, or the man who could take on the machine and win. Michigan's Abdul El Sayed has narrowly succeeded in becoming the state's Democratic candidate for the Senate. And FIFA apologises for the World Cup sell-off plan, pledging support for Gianni Infantino. Join me for The World Today.
Here on the Country Hour, well, there's a lot of interest in picking mushrooms these days, but every year authorities get around 900 calls to the poisons information line, with about a third of those people ending up in hospital. In New South Wales, it's legal to pick mushrooms in forests, but what are the risks when foraging for your own mushrooms? Emily Middleton has this report from the central west of New South Wales.
Celebrated for its romantic notions and seasonal eating opportunities, foraging for wild mushrooms has grown in popularity in the last few years. However, experts are warning that without proper education, it could have some serious consequences.
I'm primarily a mushroom forager during the autumn and winter seasons here in Orange on the slopes of Mount Canopus.
Robbie Robinson has been a professional forager for 40 years, and he supplies restaurants across Sydney and regional New South Wales with wild mushrooms, sourced mainly from Orange in central west New South Wales. He says he learned his foraging techniques from working with chefs and other foragers.
In the early days, Michael Manners was helpful. I also knew European chefs that had been using different wild mushrooms in primarily Italy, Spain, or wherever in Europe. And from that point of view, they were very helpful in passing along knowledge to me. I read a lot as well. I tracked down people who were already known for their foraging. So it was a combination probably of conversation, reading, and because the most important thing is that you come out into the forest. You can do so much book learning or digital learning at home, but you need to come out and you need to pick.
Wild mushrooms often grow in the undergrowth of pine plantations, and while there are many edible mushrooms that can be found, including the saffron milk cap and slippery jack, there are a number of poisonous ones that can easily be mistaken as safe, the most notorious being the death cap mushroom, which can cause stomach pain and organ failure.
If you're new to foraging, it's ideal to go with someone who knows what you can or cannot pick in terms of wanting to work with them in the kitchen. And from that point of view, I think that you need to, obviously, that's where the real learning takes place. And after a while, you know which mushrooms are going to be edible. There's only a few varieties out here that are edible. And there aren't a huge quantity of mushrooms of other varieties that may not be edible. So once you've defined them by colour and smell and touch, it's like knowing that a rose is a rose and a daffodil is a daffodil. And you don't forget that knowledge, and you take it with you for the rest of your life.
While it is legal to forage in New South Wales state forests, the state's health department does not recommend picking and eating any wild mushrooms. According to the Food Safety Information Council, the Australian Poisons Information Centre receives around 900 calls yearly about people eating wild mushrooms, with around 1 in 3 cases requiring hospital treatment. Julian Cox is an Associate Professor of Food Microbiology at UNSW Sydney and also the Scientific Director of the Food Safety Information Council. And he says while there has been a resurgence in foraging, there continues to be a lot of unspoken risk.
I really can't see the return on investment, to be honest. Again, I think there's a romance around it. There's a certain amount of inner reward, I guess, to be able to say, look, I picked this myself. But again, the risk is so high, particularly when it comes to mushrooms, and knowing that the death cap looks so much like a standard field mushroom that it's all too easy to confuse them. And, you know, that first mushroom could indeed be your last. So some of them can make us sick in a whole range of ways, sort of gastro-type symptoms, mind-altering, you know, hallucinogens and things like that. But also, of course, at the really severe end, they can kill you. So something like a death cap mushroom, half a large cap can kill an adult. With more generally, in a food safety sense, of course, anything could be contaminated within the natural environment by, say, fecal matter from various animals, and that might carry bad bugs from bacteria through to parasites.
Described as a hand-me-down process by Mr. Cox, his concern lies in potential unknowing consumers.
They may know someone who has been doing this for all their life and shows them, okay, this is okay, this one's not. But I always worry that, you know, one misstep, one bad pick, and that chef could be potentially causing harm to their patrons.
For more than 25 years, expert forager and educator in foraging in Lithgow, Diego Bonetto, says it's great to see more people picking wild produce, but he says getting the correct up-to-date, hands-on education is key.
So you need to get taught the basic line. The people who actually hurt themselves is because they don't know what they're doing. Or the opposite, like in case of the Victoria lady, she knew exactly what she was doing. Yeah, so mushroom pickers are not people with a death wish. They go out, I might be living tomorrow or not. Mushroom people go out because they know there's amazing, fantastic, nutritious food out there. You just do it in knowledge. And this has been happening forever, since time began, okay? So it's not something new. The something new is the people with assumption of knowledge. So go out with someone, at least for the first, second time, to know what to do. And there's a lot of people who self-train themselves and look on the internet and go out about with the apps. And that's the way people get hurt and makes it look bad for everyone else. I've been doing it for decades.
That's forager and educator Diego Bonetto ending that report on foraging for mushrooms, put together by Emily Middleton. And yes, we've got a text in from Mal who's saying foraging for mushrooms, he says it's perfect for a family beef Wellington. That one from Mal. It's coming up to 7 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Yes, and on that illegal dam story that we just heard and the $100,000 fine, we're getting a text from Greg at Cooma who says that fine, in his view, is inadequate. He says, illegally stealing the water, that's a joke. He says, on the Lachlan, his neighbours, they self-reported and they got to negotiate a small fine of $100,000. It doesn't say when that was or how long ago that was. Maybe it was prior to NRA, I don't know. He says that small fine didn't even cover the cost of the water that they'd stolen. And then he said that the last time that property of 3,600 hectares sold, it actually sold for $98 million. So $100,000, Greg from Cooma is suggesting, is not a sufficient deterrent. It's time to go to markets. First up, let's go to Wagga Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. 29,950 lambs and 9,950 sheep. And in the mix, 3,200 new season's lambs. Most of the usual buyers made it to the sale. And it was a yarding with plenty of weight, with a good percentage of grain-fed lambs. Trade lambs were limited and quality varied. It was a very erratic market, making it difficult to follow at times. New season's trade lambs slipped $6, $2.42 to $2.90. Old trade lambs were firm to $6 cheaper. Light lambs sold 6 to 10 easier. Heavy lambs were firmed to a few dollars dearer. Trade lambs, the old, 210 to 290, 24 to 26, 280 to 313, 26 to 30 kilo, 305 to 355, over 30 kilos, 348 to $436. Merino trades, 209 to 269. Heavy merino lambs, 282 to 350. It was a mixed yarding of mutton and competition was notably weaker. Heavy sheep were 20 to $25 cheaper, odd sales more, selling from 215 to 295. Trades sheep were back $10, 158 to 224. With the sheep market still in progress, Leanne Dax, MLA.
Let's go to Dubbo Cattle now and David Monk.
Numbers lifted by 650 for a yarding of 3,480. It was a very plain quality yarding with large numbers of secondary cattle lacking condition throughout. There were only odd pens of well-finished yearlings and cows yarded, along with a few lots of well-finished grass steers and heifers. Young cattle of the trade were around firm, with the primary feeders and yearlings selling to 550. Feeder steers and plainer quality feeder heifers were 40 cents cheaper, while better quality feeder heifers were 10 cents cheaper. Feeder steers sold from 400 to 566, while the feeder heifers sold from 400 to 526. Young cattle of the restockers were 40 to 70 cents cheaper, with the young steers selling to 546, while the young restocker heifers sold from 270 to 525. Grass steers and heifers were 10 to 20 cents cheaper, with the prime ground steers selling from 425 to 460. Prime ground heifers sold to 470. Cows were 8 to 15 cents cheaper, with the 2 and 3 scores selling from 220 to 385, while the prime heavyweights sold from 370 to 412 to average 396. Heavy bulls sold to 429. This is David Monk reporting from Dubbo.
Let's go to Yass Cattle now and Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Numbers were steady at 657. The quality was a little better, with more weight through the sale, and most of the feeders were heavyweights. There was only a limited supply of grown steers and a mixed run to grown heifers, and around 140 cows were penned. Young cattle were cheaper. Well-covered grown cattle also eased, but the cows were dearer. Weaner steers reached 570, heifers 503, back around 20 cents. Mid and heavy feeder steers lost 10 cents, 464 to 530. Yearling heifer slipped 3 to 5, with feeders 424 to 506. Trade steers eased 10 and reached 500 cents, but heavy yearling steers over 500 were dearer, making to 530. The best of the prime bullocks reached 480. Prime grown heifers lost 18 cents, topping at 436. Heavy prime four-score cows were 12 cents stronger, 395 to 426. The leaner two-scores gained 4, 310 to 374.
That's Graham Richard with that report, and that's the market information for today.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Just going back to those figures about H5 bird flu, there are now, as of today, just a short time ago, we got the details from the federal government, 123 cases confirmed or presumed positive detections of H5 bird flu in Australia. Testing at CSIRO's lab confirmed a further 16 positive detections today, including in Victoria, one silver gull and one magpie, as well as a range of other birds there. Six further confirmed positive detections in South Australia, but they're reminding everyone that there remains no detections in poultry or in our agricultural production systems, and the risk to human health remains low, and they're urging people, you can still eat eggs and eat chicken, of course. But if you do see any sick or dying birds, a reminder, and I should have said this earlier, the bird flu hotline number is 1-800-675-888. Yes, the number there, the bird line hot flu, the bird flu hotline number is 1-800-675-888. So if you see any sick or dying birds, that's the number to call. Don't go near them yourself. And they'll get the experts out to confirm or to determine whether or not that bird has died from bird flu or is sick from bird flu. You're listening to The Country Hour. We're heading up to news time.